Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist. Kate, are you there?
I'm here. I'm
Yay!
Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist.
And today is Friday, October 17th, 2008. It's 1 o'clock Eastern time, so if you're listening now, you're listening live. I think we were on a minute or two late today, but that's okay. We're here now. We're ready. And today we're continuing the topic we've discussed for the past couple of weeks, and that's understanding sensory issues in toddlers and young preschoolers. And the main purpose of today's show is to try to connect all the things we've talked about in the last two shows by discussing how sensory processing disorder might look in everyday life. And specifically, we'll talk about how these issues affect a child's social and emotional development, as well as how it affects them in everyday routines, including his play skills. Okay, can you tell I just ran up the flight of stairs?
Yeah.
I'm so out of breath. You're going to have to talk for a second.
Okay. I wasn't prepared for that. You like to throw me those zingers, but anyway, everyday life.
Well, I need CPR. You can talk or you can give me CPR. I don't
care. That would be kind of like real nursing, and you know I don't do that, so I'll just talk. Yeah, Laura was talking about everyday life, and that is certainly something as therapists with what young children we do see, and over time it becomes pretty obvious to us. But I think for, an average parent, it's not so obvious, and sometimes even particularly Laura, but I've had some professionals who, and that may be a pediatrician or some other doctor or a psychologist. And, you know, it's something like one of those things that when it's your child, it may not be so obvious. But we are going to talk today about, what does this really look like, and how, if a child has sensory issues, how does that kind of manifest itself in behavioral aspects? So I think that was kind of a neat thing to talk about, because like it'll help parents recognize what it really looks like, you know, is your child. And not to say that every child who exhibits these particular behaviors has sensory issues, but I think frequently there is some connection there. It could be some other issue as well, but a lot of times it may have a sensory base, even if there's something else being involved. Don't you think, Laura?
I totally do. And, you know, if you've been listening the last few weeks and wondering how a child's sensory processing difficulties could tie into late talking, there is certainly a connection. Not all late talkers have sensory processing disorders, but most toddlers with significant sensory processing disorders have some kind of their communication skills are affected, as well as their social skills, emotional skills, and we're going to talk about that all today. Okay, and if we have enough time, when we finished that, we're going to talk about the recommendations that Lucy Jane Miller uses in her book, Sensational Kids, with the strategies with how she teaches parents and other professionals to figure out how they can take a specific situation with a child who's having difficulty with that and then learn a cool little method to help you figure out ways that you can help that child deal with that particular problem. So first, that's my home phone, sorry. We're going to talk about this neat checklist that we found from that great website that we've been talking about in the last few weeks. And the website is sensory-processing-disorder.com. And I just cannot say enough good stuff about that site. I love it. And if there's a parent out there who's really looking for a family-friendly, non-medical site to get more information about things you can do with your child to help identify sensory processing disorders and, more importantly, ways to treat that at home, again, this is the site for you. If you like my website at teachmetotalk.com about language issues, I would think this was on the same level of that as giving parent-friendly information. So, again, it's sensory-processing-disorder.com.
Yeah, one thing, I don't think they field the emails and, you know, personal responses that you do, which I think is really cool about yours, but as far as general information, this is good. I would go a step further, Laura, and say that I'd like some OTs to be looking at some of this.
Yeah.
not just parents. Sometimes we have some great OTs in our program, and I don't mean to say anything, to, you know, against that, but sometimes they may understand things, but they don't necessarily know how to turn that around and make it something that parents are clear about
or other professionals on their team.
Yes, right.
They may try to explain a sensory processing disorder maybe to a new therapist who's sitting there, and then maybe it's a speech person who doesn't have that background, or goodness knows if it's a developmental interventionist and had maybe gotten so little training about that, you know, at the formal level in their master's program. And it really takes a good OT who can not only identify it in a kid, but then explain it in a way that a parent or another professional who's not an OT can understand it. And then, better than that, give them real-life activities that can truly make a difference in how that child performs.
Right.
So I think you're right. It's a great site for professionals, too.
It is. They would, you know, might be a little simplistic for them. However, it's great on how do you turn around and make this something that parents can get a handle on and really kind of begin to understand. Because I think, like you said, I just finished a master's a couple years ago in interdisciplinary early childhood education, which is what the state of Kentucky thought was the desired degree for developmental interventionists. And honestly, sensory issues were not discussed by one professor. The only time it was touched upon was by a woman who was already a preschool teacher who had adopted a child, and he happened to have sensory issues, so she gave a brief presentation on sensory issues. But that's so little, and it's such a pervasive thing that affects development really in all areas, and it's, I think, shocking that you could, you know, graduate from an accredited program in recent years and learn nothing formal about the whole topic. So this website is worth its weight in gold.
It really is, and especially for people who are like you and me, who've worked for a while and who didn't get it on that at that formal level too. I think it's for anybody who might need a refresher. Okay, so let's start by talking about the social difficulties that a child with sensory processing disorder might have. The first one is difficulty getting along with peers. So that would mean an older child might have a hard time making friends. You might see a kid on the playground who's by himself a lot, or if he wants to join in, he doesn't quite know how to join in a game. For younger children, I think it's almost that the parents see that the child has difficulty getting along with other children. The kid may be really aggressive or really withdrawn, and that may scare another parent, and they may think, I'm not going to set up play dates with that kid because he's a little out there, you know, he's too rough for my kid, or I don't understand why he does the same thing over and over and over and over. So that may even discourage socialization from a parent's perspective because another parent doesn't necessarily want their kid or go out of their way to make sure that their kid plays with that other child. I think that happens in families a lot. Don't you hear where a mom might say, well, my brother's asked me not to bring my child over to his house anymore because last time we were there, it was a disaster.
Mm-hmm. Also in the daycare setting, and sometimes it kind of becomes an issue when a child hasn't been in preschool or daycare and then they, for whatever reason, begin to go, and all of a sudden this child is being labeled, you know, bad, and he's aggressive and he's mean. And in the past, maybe it wasn't even a significant problem at home, but a lot of times what I see is the parents kind of know how to accommodate the child well. the older child knows what he can or she can do, and they keep the baby away from the toddler because they know he tends to hit or push or bite or scratch. But in a daycare setting, when it's, say, 10 2-year-olds all in the same room, you know, it's pretty difficult, if not impossible, to make those accommodations. And so because really of the sensory-based issues, that kid starts hitting and pushing and scratching and grabbing things aggressively, and it's not necessarily, you know, that they don't know how to share, or that they're mean, but they're so sensitive perhaps to being in close proximity to other kids, or they're really sensitive about being touched by other people. And, you know, 2-year-olds offend those boundaries all the time. You know, they're real close. And you talked today, Laura, about a child you had seen.
I did. I just evaluated a little girl this morning, and I thought about this show so much when I was doing the evaluation because she was so defensive with touch. And she was in, I was in an early Head Start program, which I'd never been to this program before, and the children in the classroom today were, she was one of the younger children. They were 14 or 15 months up to two, but there were six kids there, two little girls, three boys, and they were, or I guess four boys, and the kids were all over the little girl that I was about to evaluate or trying to evaluate. And she, during book time, you know, she, I had her in my lap and the teacher's reading the story. And so naturally, you know, what happens when a friendly lady goes into a daycare situation and you're smiling at the kids and you're talking to them, they all want to sit in your lap. And so kids were climbing all over her, and she hated it. She would, every time somebody touched her, she would whine or either throw herself down on the floor and break out in a big cry because she could not stand that close proximity with other kids crawling all over her. When I took the bubbles out to just kind of do an activity with all of them while the teacher was changing diapers, you know, other kids in their excitement to pop the bubbles would step on her. She might get shoved a little bit. And even they weren't really being aggressive. They were just trying to pop the bubbles. And she was so defensive. She hated it. You know, she would cry and, again, try to scoot herself back. And then the next time I would blow bubbles, they would go back further. And then the children would run to get the bubbles and climb all over. And she just hated it. She just was a mess because of how often she was touched by the other children. So, yeah, you see that. And, you know, not looking at it, if you were looking at it from a sensory perspective, you realize it's because of the touch. But from a social perspective, she didn't look like she liked the other kids. She didn't look like she wanted to play at all. So that's the kind of thing that we're talking about today. It causes social problems as well.
I was going to interject. The other one is those kids who are kind of hyposensitive to touch or tactile stimulation. They can be really aggressive because they're kind of unaware of how, you know, hard they're passing something or banging something. And so they tend to be, again, get the bad kid label because they tend to smash into kids and, you know, they just don't really have much awareness.
Yeah, and that smashing feels good to them because their little bodies need so much more input to even feel it. And so if there were a kid like that in her class with this little girl that I evaluated today, she's so over-responsive with that kind of thing and just didn't like it at all. And if she had a crasher and her banger in her class, that would be terrible because he would constantly want to run into her and she would constantly be fighting that and trying to get away from him or falling apart when he touched her just a little bit, and he would be touching her more and more and more because that felt great to him, and he knew where his body was in space. So, yeah, that would be a recipe for disaster in that particular classroom. And then think how the teacher would feel constantly like she had to separate those kids or constantly be thinking ahead, oh, what's this going to do to this little girl? What's this going to do to this little boy if we do this activity? So that takes a really careful caregiver, which we all know may not even exist in a daycare situation, somebody who's constantly having to think ahead. So it could pose a problem. One other social difference that you might see is that a child might prefer playing by himself with objects or toys rather than people. And we see that all the time with children that we see for therapy. We go in, we have a cool toy. He doesn't want me playing with him. He's going to hunker down over it or take it to the corner and turn his back to me. So there's no possible way that I can interject myself into that play. And just imagine how that really affects his language development as well, because he does not get the same opportunities to hear the same words, to participate in the conversation, to even just get the same kinds of opportunities for that back and forth turn-taking that you do when you play, when you're hunkered down and only want to play with it by yourself.
And again, I would say, you know, all of these are not necessarily attributable to one area of defensiveness or lack of sensitivity as far as all those sensory things that we kind of highlighted last week. And it's, you know, really kind of the job of an OT or Perhaps maybe some other professional, but generally it's OTs. But there is so often a sensory base to that, like this child who prefers to play by him or herself. That could be they're really sensitive to noises. That could
sure.
be, you know, it could be any number.
It could be
number.
The touch thing. Yeah,
could,
like we
yes.
talked about with the little girl I evaluated today. She didn't always seek out those other opportunities with the other kids because she was so defensive about them touching her. But you're exactly right. Or a kid who really might crave so much visual input, he may want to have that toy 2 feet in front of his face. And so to do that,
two inches.
Yeah,
I was going to say, you're generous.
two inches right there. And so he doesn't want to share because he wants to get all that visual input himself. And so what's he going to do? He's going to run to the other side of the room and hold it up so that another kid doesn't try to grab it from him or another teacher's not there to sort of take it away. So you're right. There could be lots of reasons, sensory processing-wise, that a kid does that particular thing. But it ends up looking like he isolates himself and wants to play by himself rather than play with other people.
And again, sometimes those are behaviors that parents witness or observe at home, and sometimes they're not as much because the environment is familiar to the child, it's more controlled. Certainly parents sometimes are aware of these tendencies in their children, but sometimes they kind of become more obvious or more exaggerated because they've taken them and put them in preschool or daycare or whatever.
Or even a birthday party.
Yes, because there's so much more going on. There's so much more
right.
noise and light and activity and just all the sensory stimulation, and it kind of tends to exaggerate these tendencies. You know, sometimes
right.
kids exhibit them regardless of where they are, but sometimes they become more pronounced when they're in that more sensory-rich environment because, bam, they're being bombarded by all those things that can be somewhat difficult for them. So,
yeah,
sorry,
that's Laura. A good point. That's okay. Another social difference might be that these kids are things that cause the social differences. The kids appear to be self-abusive or abusive to others. We talked about this a little bit with a kid who, like you said, might crave all that sensory input. So he might give a kid, pass a toy to another kid, you know, harder than another kid would like, or he's all over him, or even to the point that it is, even if he's not meaning to, say, knock another kid down, you know, he's just excited about getting to the slide, but he plows over 3 kids in his excitement to get over there and get to do the slide, and he doesn't even realize that he's being abusive to other kids. This could also include a kid who might be abusive to himself, like a biter. And so he starts biting, and what's the preschool teacher going to do, or what's the parent going to do? You're going to try to isolate that kid from other people because you're going to think, oh, he's biting himself. He might end up biting other people, too. Or, again, it's a situation where a parent might be afraid for their own child to play with another kid like that because they're scared. You know, that's different. Why is that kid banging his head all the time? Why is that little boy acting, you know, he's biting his arm, he's biting his shirt. What's going on with that? It looks weird. It looks different. So it makes other people more leery to have social interaction or let their children have social interaction with you. And, again, that becomes a social problem. Did you want to talk about that for a little bit?
Well,
let me add this. I have a little guy that just turned 3 that I don't see anymore, but he was a headbanger. And his mom said that so scared people at his sister's birthday party, even older children. You know, I think the older little girl was turning probably 7 or 8, and my little guy just became a spectacle at his sister's birthday party because he was overstimulated and kept banging his head, and it did kind of, the mom said it just kind of stopped the whole party. You know, everybody sat and looked at it, and you're like, why is he doing it? Ooh, look at that. And so, again, you can imagine the social problems that it caused, not for only for this little boy, but for the parents. They were embarrassed. And it's really hard to scoop this little guy up. I bet he weighs, 40 pounds turning 3, maybe more than that. He was heavy. And he was a headbanger and a biter. He's a little boy that bit me this summer. I think I've referred to that. But
yes, I believe I have heard of that a time or two.
Heard that story, yes. But
not
going to
bite me again. No more biting Laura. Yeah, that's a bad one when they take a hunk out of you.
It
We've
is.
We've all had it a time or two.
Yeah, and that kind of abusive behavior you do, even me as his therapist who loves him to death, it made me a little cautious around him, thinking, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to pick him up today. I think this might be a biting day. Oh, I'm not going to let him jump off the couch right into my arms if I'm thinking he's going to latch those little teeth into my shoulder again. So, again, it causes those social problems.
Well, and it can be hard. Sometimes it's fairly obvious if a child's mad and they start doing those things, but other times it can appear to be fairly random.
Out of the blue.
You think, what the heck happened?
Yeah.
Yes, where did that come from? I remember, as I recall, Laura, when that happened to you with that little boy, he was doing very well.
And then, bam, he just bit
your shoulder, you know, I mean, and hard.
I had a bruise for a couple of weeks over a shirt. You know, that happened. I had little teeth marks. That's how hard he bit me. I could hardly get him off me. You know, he just totally, it came out of the blue. It was a complete shock to me, to his mom, everybody, because he was having such a great day.
And, you know, perhaps if we could stand back and watch the situation, maybe it would have been more obvious, because I do believe generally there is some trigger. There is, you know, even if it's just generally the child was overstimulated. And
well, that's what I was going to say with him, because he was so happy, deliriously happy that day, that it was just easy to kind of go over the edge. And, you know, again, he was jumping off the couch that day, and he probably did it half a dozen, well, probably closer to a dozen times before it was one too many times, and I should have pulled back and thought, okay, we're getting too close to the edge here. He's happy, he's having a good time. We need to move on to another activity before it becomes so overstimulating for him.
But, hey, hindsight's 20/20,
yeah.
And I'm sure you were thrilled to have him so happy, because, as I recall again, he wasn't always the happiest little fella, so here he was doing beautifully.
Right.
And you were just thrilled, as was his mother, I'm sure, and then, boom.
Yeah,
you know,
but we learned to read his cues a little better after that. Needless to say, I did not have another day like that again. He did not bite me again, because I was more careful about it.
Right.
Which, again, was a good thing in that situation. But the opposite, you know, we may have missed out on some other social opportunities because I was still a little cautious with what am I going to let him do with me today? You know, how am I going to manage this?
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how it could go the other way. Or with somebody who's not thinking ahead, you know, somebody who maybe a teacher might have been in that same situation and thought, I'm never going to hold him again. I'm never going to let him jump to me again because of that one time that he bit me without really thinking about it therapeutically and clinically like I thought about it, you know, from the point that it happened on.
And I personally see that a fair amount with daycare workers, preschool teachers, whatever, people, caregivers who deal with young children, they do tend to think say, which is even worse, sometimes within earshot of the child,
right.
He's bad, he's mean, he's ugly, he's whatever, and you think, oh, I don't know, I have a hard time, and I guess this is, the older I get, the more true this is, but I have a hard time thinking of a two-year-old as bad, as mean, as, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I know they all have different temperaments and dispositions, and there's certainly some who are easier than others. I mean, I'm not completely unrealistic, but you know, I do think a lot of times, and I'm not educated enough to venture a guess, but I think a lot of times there is some sensory underlying issue, you know, that he or he's wired differently, and we can look at that in sensory terms, and it's not a bad issue. It's not a, you know, and there tend to be more difficult kids, and parenting and caregiving for them is harder, but I don't know. It just breaks my heart to hear kids being labeled as bad and mean and ugly and being booted out of facilities because they're the bad one. And I think,
a lot of the time it really could be a sensory processing disorder or a severe communication issue or something that really has caused those behaviors. You know, I see that a lot too with kids who are, you know, headbangers or hitters or biters or whatever. They're so frustrated because they can't communicate that they really are viewed as a behavior problem when really the root of all that is lack of communication. So
coupled with
it breaks my heart too. Yeah.
It does. And a lot of times they do, those kids with that communication delay also have some underlying sensory things. So you know, it's the double-edged sword, and who can blame them? It would be very challenging to be two and know exactly what you want and not be able to tell people. And they learn to be kind of more extreme in their behaviors, and because they have to get attention without saying, it's my ball, you know.
They, right. They don't
have
the skills
to, let them know.
To be able to do that. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they jerk it away or take it away or always looking aggressive when really that's not the root of the problem.
Right.
Okay, another social issue that we see with children with sensory processing disorder is that those children may not seek out connections with familiar people. And again, you know, you always think about kids who are on the autism spectrum, you know, the kids who are pretty self-isolated. Sometimes those kids do, though, have a great, you know, maybe one pretty good connection with one parent. And then you kind of go the other way where people say, well, he can't be autistic because he likes his mom too much. He connects with his mom. And that's not true either. But you do have children who are on the spectrum who do look like that, that they don't really seek out those connections. They don't initiate. And, again, some of that or all of that leads to communication problems. You're not going to know what his needs are if he doesn't have a way to initiate and seek out the connection to let you know what they are. And then a parent might not be able to or be as responsive when a kid isn't clamoring for attention. You were talking about a kid that you saw today in that same situation, who the little boy didn't really initiate or want to communicate with the mom, but then his younger sister did. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, it was, I've been seeing him for a while now, and
okay.
He doesn't actually have a formal diagnosis of apraxia, but all things look like that's probably what's going on with him. He's a really smart, cute little fella, but, I mean, words are just, so he can sometimes pop out a few, but he's 28 months now, or almost 28 months. And as I said, very bright, understands words, you know, follows lots of directions, can respond appropriately to lots of things. But his mom was saying today, she has a one-year-old, her little girl just turned one, and she was saying that the little girl just basically refuses to be ignored. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, she just does anything and everything she can to get my attention and to demand that I respond. And furthermore, she went on to say, and I've seen this little girl, you know, in the background for about 6 months, and it's been obvious, since she was 6 months old, she was screaming to get off the couch and try and come down and be with, you know, the little boy and I who are on the floor.
Right.
And same kind of thing. I'm trying to do uh-oh or whatever it is, some sign or word approximation with the boy, and the darn 8-month-old sitting on the couch doing everything I'm trying to get the boy, the 2-year-old to do. You know, sometimes
yeah.
I'm like, shh. You know, it's kind of painful, again, because you're working so hard with the older one and the little one sitting there doing it like, that's easy. And, of course, it
yeah.
is easy for her, but she was making the point that if she sneezed, the child sneezed. If she coughed, the child coughed. And
right. And
today, again, as she was on the couch, the mom tries to hold her back because this child, he's one of those, he does have some sensory issues, and one of his is he kind of needs a lot of feedback. Yeah, he's kind of a crasher. And at one point he was fairly aggressive with his little sister. Thankfully that's gotten a lot better. But he just, you know, he doesn't ever pound a ball that he isn't booming it, and he doesn't ever jump that he isn't flying across. He's darling, but you know, he's just one of those, needs a lot to kind of get his, he's the little guy I talked about a week ago who ate the hot fries and loves them, and you know, I'm saying water they're hot, and he thinks they're delicious because he can taste them. But anyway, she was saying that he never really demanded that attention, that he never really did much. He was fairly, as I said, bright and independent, didn't really. And I said, well, you know what? He really couldn't, because of that verbal apraxia thing he has going on. He couldn't imitate mommy saying, uh-oh, or do the raspberries or any of those things. And I think I was saying to you, Lauren, I don't know that this is terribly relevant, but I guess it is as it relates to speech and language development. as he didn't make those demands on her, and I'm not saying anything I didn't say to her, I just think this is human nature. I don't really know that the mom really tried as much with him because go ahead.
She probably didn't, because that's just human nature, like you're saying. If it's too hard to get a kid to interact with you, you give up. You move on. You answer the phone. You do the laundry. His little sister, on the other hand, probably totally demanded her attention and really lit up and engaged, you know, when she did give her that attention. So then the mom thought, oh, this is fun. I'm going to keep this going. And it just went back and forth and back and forth. And your little guy couldn't do that. He couldn't respond, so it probably became a little easier for the mom just not to try as hard, because she wouldn't get the same responses that she would get, like, from now her younger child. And I think you're exactly right. It's a vicious cycle. And who's to say what came first? Was it the kid not being able to respond or the mom not trying harder? But, again, it's a big cycle, so it goes, keeps going. And that's what leads to the social. And that's sort of the example. I think I was thinking about something else, but that's what I was talking about with this, is that when a kid doesn't seek out connections with familiar people, they're not going to get reinforced for being with other people, and then they're going to miss out on all the language. And like with your little guy, the opportunities to blow raspberries when you're a baby, to learn those early little play sounds. His mom probably didn't do a ton of, what's the duck say? What's the cow say? What's the chicken say? You know, all those little things that she might do with her now 1-year-old, because he couldn't respond in that way.
Yes, and I hear parents say a lot, you know, they are very willing and sometimes eager almost to take kind of ownership of, well, I didn't work on that. I didn't do that.
Right.
He doesn't do that because I don't ask him to. And sometimes there's some merit to that, but a lot of times I think it's because they've learned he's probably not going to respond to that, and so therefore they don't kind of up the ante and continue to encourage and, you know, ask their kids to do those things because they don't really get a response. And she was kind of feeling guilty, and I said, well, you did what was natural. He really wasn't able to. And with her, you don't really have a choice. And she's darling, but she does demand it the way that social little happy babies do, you know.
That's normal. That's typical development. That's what we want to see with kids, is them really clamoring for your attention, with them really seeking you out and wanting to be with you and following you from room to room and doing things to get your attention. That's normal social development. That's normal communicative development. And if you have a kid who's not doing that, that should be a red flag. And you should think, okay, he's not seeking me out. He's not trying to imitate me when I'm doing these things. That's a huge red flag. You know, again, not only for his language, but for social development as well. All right, let's move on.
Laura,
to the
let
emotion.
Me say one quick note on this. Does not seek out connections with familiar people. You talked about in that social area, and we were talking about sensory things, and you said something about autistic kids, and I know this is not about autism today. We will get there in a week or two or three.
Right.
Huge, huge hot topic of the day, unfortunately. But one thing I did want to say about that, whether we're talking about a child who's autistic or a child who has moderate to severe sensory issues or maybe on the autism spectrum, and we're not going to say which it is, but one of those things. Don't you see, you said something about sometimes they're very connected to one parent.
Yeah,
and
sometimes they really are.
Right, and I've certainly seen that, and parents will certainly, as I would, I'm sure, in their situation, cling to that, and they'll say, oh, but a lot of times, don't you see that it's like a really, really physical connection? Like,
well,
they want
that. That's just what I was picturing in my mind when we were thinking about this. I'm thinking of the two particular moms, and they're not moms that I currently have right now, but both of those moms were in huge denial about the possibility that their both little boys could possibly be autistic, because they both felt like that they were too connected to them. You know, oh, but he is social with me. Oh, he does seek me out. But you are exactly right. It's always the physical thing. And I can just see both these little boys backing up into their moms. It's not like running with arms open, with making great eye contact, or with screaming, "Mama, Mama." It's seeing mom seated on the floor and turning around and kind of backing into her.
Right, for protection, for physical comfort. They crawl on them, they lay on them, they pat their hair, they snuggle with them, but it's not even as social as, and you know, the kids I've seen, let's say, they're two and over, and babies are more really social. I guess I think of social as they're looking at them, they're smiling at them.
Well, it's a qualitative difference. It really
right.
is.
Huge
because to the mom.
And go ahead. I mean, I'd say, yes, there is a big connection, but it's really not very social.
Right. Or I remember this one little guy. The thing he always did to his mom, and she would say, "No, he comes to get me." Do you know what he would do? He would walk up to her, latch his arm between her legs, and totally just, you know, put all the weight that he could on his mom. You know, it's the leaner that we talked about last week, a kid who, you know, constantly leans. That's what he did all the time. And so that's how she felt like. He is initiating conversation with me. He is initiating communication when really he would walk up whenever she was standing, you know, put his arm through one of her legs or wrap himself around her, and that, again, he was seeking that out, but was it a true, you know, him going in and asking her for a drink? No. Was it him calling her when he was stuck behind the couch? No. That was the only time that he did it, but it was so hard to make her see that distinction because she felt like he's doing it. He is social. This is our relationship, and I think it's, too, it's hard as a mom because it's to acknowledge that there is that qualitative difference there because that's all they have.
Right. And like and with this mom, and this child is not at all on spectrum or anything like that, but she really was saying, now I see what a typical child does. Now I see what real social engagement looks like because the daughter, you know, who's just a cute little one-year-old,
normal little baby.
Man.
Yeah.
Today when I was trying to get out of the door and say, you know, I had to go, I got to go, the little one-year-old made it over the door knowing I was saying I was, you know, telling him bye, and she went over to the door and she turned around to me and she looked at me with a great big smile and gave me this big fake laugh like, "I made it to the door. I know what you're talking about." And it was so cute, but it was so social. You know,
yeah.
I said, "Look at that. She's not even really."
Me.
Yeah. She wasn't even really laughing. I mean, I don't think it was really. She was proud of herself, to be sure. But it was, aren't I cute? And it was like, "Yeah, you're darling." But that's social, you know.
And she can't say, "Kate, look.
So yeah. Are you going to go? I'll get to the door." But she was saying it, wasn't she? Yeah. Because I don't want people to think because a child doesn't have the words that they can't communicate or that they can't be social, because we certainly see lots of kids who have very few, if any, words initially, and yet they're quite social.
I have kids that I'll get the referral on kind of late. You know, they might be what I would consider nonverbal, you know, or minimally verbal, less than 10 words at well over 2 at 26 or 28 months. And the reason that they haven't gotten a referral yet is because the pediatrician told the parent, "He understands everything, and look, you know, you know how to meet his needs. He lets you know because he's the kid that's pointing, that's, you know, again, real engaged with you." I have a little guy that has apraxia that's turning 3 on my caseload right now, too, and he doesn't even need words. You know exactly what he's thinking by looking at that sweet little face because he's so expressive. You can tell when he's happy. You can tell when he's mad. You can tell when he's disappointed. You can tell when he's scared. You know, everything by just his facial expressions. And so, you know, and he did speech early on. He's not one of the kids I'm talking about. But sometimes you get kids that communicate so well without words because they are so darn social. So, again, you're right. It doesn't necessarily take the words to make you social.
Right.
There is a big difference there.
I think sometimes people discount or think, "Oh, well, they're talking about words, and he can't talk, so how could he possibly communicate?" And really, like that example you just gave, if they're really social, that little one-year-old she can imitate some words, and I think she uses a couple on her own, but really she's nonverbal for the most part. But boy, does she let you know.
And right. Well, my little Jack, when I would get there, he couldn't talk, but when he saw me, I could see him. They lived in a condo. And I would look up, and he's jumping up and down in the window looking at me, you know, putting his hands on his face like, oh, you're here. And then I could hear him, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, run to the door, fling the door open, you know, and just a huge grin like, you're here, you're here. And again, no words, no words. He squealed a lot when I first saw him, but again, that was his.
That one sound, he could,
excited,
get, he could get
I'm
out.
Excited.
Yeah, woo!
You're here, you're here. Yeah, and but so social. Never a question of that he didn't have a connection. And he, I think, almost was hypersocial because he couldn't do it with words. And so he learned, this is how I act. This is what I do. This is how Mommy knows what I want. I can use my face. I can use my body. She can tell what I mean.
Right. Sometimes they are, when they really don't have the words, they are almost over, it's darling, but you know what I mean, it's a little extreme because they have to make it real big for people to get it, and they're good at it.
And that's like this little boy did not, I just went to his IEP meeting this week, you know, because he's turning three. He has gotten OT this whole time for sensory issues because everything that he does is so big and so exaggerated and, you know, again, I guess you could look at him and kind of think he's a crasher and stuff, but the school OT said this, and it just hit me between the eyes. She said, don't you think he's had to have all those huge movements and huge reactions so that he could communicate? And I thought, darn, if you aren't right, that is so true about him. And he's smart. So he's learned how to do that, and he's learned how to compensate for his social, or he's learned how to compensate socially for his lack of communication. Which, again, makes them, you know, does he have sensory issues? Does he not have sensory issues? The school didn't think so, or they felt like that he wasn't going to be eligible for services. I think that down the road, that preschool teacher may end up calling OT back in anyway just for some additional ideas. But, you know, she had a good point. Mm-hmm. He had to learn how to be that way so that he could get his needs met and communicate. So there you go. That was really interesting to hear. Okay, let's move on.
Yeah, we better because we love these topics, but we're moving very slowly.
Very slowly.
For people who, as long as we can work language into it, we're happy. Okay, move along.
No. Okay, so we talked about the social differences with kids with sensory processing disorder, how those social differences look. Let's talk about the emotional. And again, this is such a great lead-in talking about Jack. He's kind of the other way, but again, we're tying how a kid's emotional differences might look because of his sensory processing issues. The big one is difficulty accepting changes in the routine to the point of tantrums. And we're not talking about just a little whiner here. These are the kids who get so distraught every time you're going to move from one situation to another situation. They have a hard time going anywhere because they're leaving home, and then once they get there and get settled in, they have a hard time leaving that place. You know, again, it's the transition. With the kids that we see in therapy, this might be a kid who, again, you might take a while to get him warmed up to a toy, but then, oh, my goodness, he can't let go of it. He's still wanting to play with it. 20 minutes later, after I've exhausted all the possibilities that I've squeezed out every little bit of language that I can. But the problem
is, as far as you possibly, there's some toys that we kind of have to say, okay, that's probably it.
I'm not playing with that again. I'm never bringing that in your house again.
Yeah, that's when we talked about our strategies last week. When it's that great, we probably won't bring it back for a while.
Yeah, because you can't always move on, and you can't. You know, it's really hard to then move beyond what your little routines may be. And I have lots of, you know, and you talked about this last week too, you know, I've done this job for a long time now, so I know what I'm going to say when I play with a toy because I know what generally works with most kids to get them engaged, and I know what words are going to be easier to say based on what they can say and how their mouth can move and what's going to be most novel to them. So I can usually tell after I've seen a kid for a while, okay, you know, these are the things I'm going to target. This is what I'm going to be able to get out of him. But when he hangs on to the same toy and I've got it for 20 minutes, I need to move on. for my sensory system. I've had it. It's enough. You know,
that's when you get
here.
To the mine and hide.
Yeah. There you go.
Time
that's
to hide that
going bye-bye. Yeah. Maybe
yeah,
even
okay.
out the door on the porch.
I'm pulling you back here. Difficulty accepting changes in routine. I think that two-year-olds tend to be creatures of habit anyway.
Right.
But when
this is extreme.
Yes, this is extreme. And this is very common. I hear parents, you know, they get outside, they're so darn happy. Well, good luck getting them back in the house. Or this is the kid who really, when he gets up out of bed, he expects a certain routine. And if you disrupt that, you just may pay for 30 to 40 minutes with a total meltdown. And it takes a very perceptive caregiver to even realize what in the world happened.
Right.
Well, you didn't give him his juice before you changed his diaper. Well, you didn't, whatever.
And he's mad
fill in
about
the blank.
That. Or he always watches Thomas when his brother and sister are getting ready for school, and the Thomas DVD is not there, and boy, mom has to pay for that, you know, maybe even longer than 45 minutes. Maybe the whole morning's going to be disrupted because his little routine was changed from the way that he expected it. That happens a lot, too, with, you know, kids who are going from a summertime schedule to a school year schedule. You know, they have a really hard time getting adjusted to those new routines. Or, you know, changing, like if they're in a daycare, if they bump up to the next room, you know, that may be so hard for some kids because, again, they're so kind of locked into that routine. So we're not talking about just the toddler crankiness. We are meaning extreme reactions. And again, the reason that it causes an emotional problem is because it leaves everyone around them thinking, oh no, what are we going to do? This is hard. You know, he's been crying for an hour now. How can we get him back regulated? So that's why this would be classified as an emotional a difficulty or dysfunction.
Large. Remember a little guy who moaned when he went from in-home daycare to a daycare and moaned and just really kind of moaned, cried, just this
for
low,
4 or 5 weeks.
All day. It was
and
the saddest. Yeah. He finally came around, bless his heart, really
he
nicely.
Finally
but,
did. Yeah.
But
that's all he did. He stayed in a heap by the window. He didn't even cry. You're right. He just moaned all day.
That's probably the saddest one I've ever seen. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. He ended up doing great. He looked pretty good by 3.
Yep.
Compared to where we started in right before 2.
We remind ourselves of him routinely saying,
hey,
we can do this on the next kid. We can get him. We can do this because, woo, he was a success story if there ever was one.
He really was. He really was. Okay. But back to other emotional differences or emotional difficulties. These would be the kids who get easily frustrated. Think about kids that throw toys. They can't get it to work right the first time. Boom, it's across the room. They're throwing it. A kid who apparently seems to cry over nothing. You know, one little thing happens and they're throwing themselves down in a heap of tears on the floor because they have that low frustration tolerance. They don't learn, you know, keep trying, you can do it. You know, they just try it one time, or sometimes I think they try it half a time, and then they're done with it. They're just too frustrated. And again, those are the kids who look like they're falling apart over what their typically developing peers may not have difficulty with at all. These are the kids who were appear to be impulsive, too. You know, those we've talked about the sensory seekers, the kids that look like they're go, 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 go. They don't really consider any reactions. They don't, and that creates problems for them socially because we were talking about before the example of the little boy running over, knocking down 3 of his friends to get to the slide. He doesn't realize those friends, as they start to get older, aren't going to think that's too cool anymore and are going to want to stay away from him. And that little guy looks like he's emotionally not as mature as his friends. He doesn't consider consequences. And again, you know, as a toddler, rarely is going to consider consequences. But as kids turn 3 and 4 and 5, they start thinking, you know, gosh, that hurt me. I don't understand why you're so mean to me. You know, they start kind of having those more mature and rationalizing those emotional feelings. These are the kids who also a parent might say, oh, he's going to function better if he can just do that by himself or in a small group. They might be overwhelmed if they're in a larger group. That would be a kid that might totally shut down, like at a birthday party or somewhere like that. I've had kids who look sleepy. Remember our little guy last year that would yawn like 10 minutes into therapy?
Of course, we'd be like, you're not tired.
Come on. But, you know, that's what it looks like to people, mm-hmm. is that it looks like that they're tired. And, again, their little systems are just the kids, you know, who are over-responders. They get overstimulated. Their little systems just want to shut down because it's too much. And so parents might say, you know, I can't take him to Chuck E. Cheese's, or we can't go to the family reunion. That's going to be too hard for him. Or I can't let him go to the public preschool because they're going to be, you know, that I visited that class. There are 20 kids in that class. That is way too much for them. And for some of those kids, it really is. They do just kind of shut down. And, again, that looks like an emotional difference, an emotional dysfunction there, because they you know, want to isolate and, again, shut down. These are also the kids that have those very quickly changing moods. Again, 1 minute they might be, woohoo, woohoo, everything's great, we're having fun. And then the next minute they're crying. And sometimes with not even a minute in between, they just fluctuate so quickly and they're prone to kind of outbursts and tantrums. And we've already talked about this. You think, where did that come from? What happened with that? It may have just been something that would have been just a little frustrating to another child, but not result in a full-blown tantrum.
I'll do the next one more. Can I do it?
Yeah.
These are the kids, and this is kind of related to what was already said, but they stated it a little bit differently. Prefers to play on the outside, away from groups, or just be an observer. And I certainly see this time and time again, particularly in the institutional setting at a daycare or a preschool, where the kid you're going to see is the one way on the other side of the room. He's got his puzzle or his truck, and he's rolling it back and forth, but does he really join in circle time? No. Does he really, you know, follow directions the way most of the kids in the class are? No. He's off to himself. He may have his desired, preferred things, but he doesn't tend to. And I think that kind of goes back to, I don't know, because I don't consider myself an expert by any shot, but I do think sometimes that's because if he's off to himself, he can control it, or she can control it.
Yeah,
it's
and they're not like my
predictable. Yeah,
yeah, and like my little girl today, you know, who was so assaulted by other kids touching her. If she's over by herself, there is a big chance that nobody is going to touch her, and she is going to be able to control that, and nobody's going to be in her space, nobody's going to be leaning on her, nobody's going to do anything that's going to make her have that overreaction. So, again, they do pull themselves back. You know, and a parent might look at this and say, that's not a sensory disorder. He's just shy.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's how his daddy is, too. His dad had no friends growing up. And, again,
I chuckle because we do hear that one a lot, don't we?
We hear it. We totally do.
He's just like his father.
Really, it's...
And usually it's a really social mother, don't you think? Like,
yeah.
Really outgoing.
Oh, yeah. You think, and the only man who could stand to be married to you is one who pulls himself so far back. That's the only way he can take you.
Yeah.
But, you know, that happens a lot where a parent might say, oh, that's not a sensory problem. He's just like his dad. He's just like his brother. He's just like his grandpa. He's just like my brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that happens even in my own family. You know, my mom will say, well, I'm probably not going to give those examples. But, you know, she'll say, well,
I wouldn't.
That's because blah, blah, blah,
since
blah,
she's
blah.
Our most faithful listener, I probably wouldn't.
No, but she'll, you know, she might say it about another child in the family. Well, no wonder, because look at his dad. Or
right.
No wonder, because remember when her mom was little,
yeah.
You know, and so you do, and so you don't really think about it as a sensory processing issue. You just kind of think that's their personality or that's just inherited, but sometimes it's the same. It really is a sensory processing issue that not only do, you know, does a kid have it, you know, his dad probably has some of that same makeup and so had some of those same kinds of issues.
Okay, Laura, we thought we could get through this whole list, in the hour. And we've okay, I want to ask you, the next one that this author of this website notes is avoids eye contact. What do you think of that?
I think that she's saying that kids don't make that emotional connection. It looks like an emotional difference, like they don't love anybody because they're not making that basic, very early developmental skill of making and maintaining eye contact. When you hold a 7 or 8 week baby and hold them, you're sitting down and you put them in your laps and you've got them kind of lean back on your hands and you're looking at them and going, oh, oh, ah, that baby is cooing back to you and he cannot take his eyes off you. And that's how early that skill is, and that's how fundamental eye contact is. And so I think she's meaning that it's an emotional difference or emotional dysfunction when you have a kid who avoids eye contact. And I always, almost always associate that with children who are autistic. Is that what you were thinking I was going to say?
Well, I guess I'm wondering what sensory processing issue is attributed to eye contact. That one's kind of not as obvious to me.
Oh, I see what you're saying. It might be kids who really avoid the visual thing. They want to kind of shut down that way. Or kids just who, I see what you're saying. I don't know. That's a great point. That's a great point.
I mean, I certainly agree that kids who avoid eye contact, and I mean really avoid it, you know. Sometimes kids like to play, and they're not, you're talking to them, and they're not really looking at you very well. But I mean, some kids, you see their eyes dart to the side the minute you try and look them in the eye. And, you know, typically, like you said, very young babies look you right in the eye, and if you talk to them and coo at them, their eyes twinkle. You see that special spark I'm always talking about. But
yeah,
these kids, it is almost painful. You know, you see them just really avoid it.
Well, I think it overloads their system somehow. And is it a visual overload? Is it I'm not sure exactly where we
I guess you have to think it's visual in some way, shape, or form, because we're talking about eyes, but I don't know.
But it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming to them. They cannot do it or do not do it. Or maybe that it's the other way, that you're not visually exciting enough to get their attention, because those are the kids who love those spinny light-up toys.
Yeah.
So they are really hunkered down with those. And then when start to get those kids socially is when you're playing those little games and when you're doing lots of those little routines that they like, where you're going to run them and tickle them, and then you've got them, you know, you've just chased them all the way across the room and you've gotten them and you've slammed them down on the couch and then you're tickling them, and that's when you get the eye contact. It's when you've gotten their little systems to the point where they can do it. So I don't know. That's an interesting question. If we get our friend Carrie, the OT, to come on and talk to us, or any other OT friends.
Any other great OT would like to join us 1 week, we can play that one. Well, Laura, let me give you a plug on that. Laura's website, teachmetotalk.com, she has great, 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 great ideas about early speech and language issues and things that she does day in, day out. And you do those early social games better than any person I've ever known, and you have some great, easy, parent-friendly, caregiver-friendly ideas on your website about, you know, things that you do and have great success with. So if you're wondering, now, what is she talking about? Those early, not just Goo Goo Gaga, but little songs, little routines, you have some great ones on there, and I've referred a lot of my mommies to your website in general, but also that section. Sometimes I'm working with the two-year-old, and they're saying, you know, I'm kind of worried about my one-year-old. And I say, you know what? Go to her website and check that out, because you do a great job. And you show some of them on your DVD also, but that has early, little. And just because a child's two, if he doesn't kind of have those emotional foundation skills, it really doesn't matter if you're playing peekaboo with him. If he's twinkling,
right,
if his eyes are lighting up and he's laughing and smiling and responding, peekaboo is just fine. You know?
Right, and you've got to meet him where he is to be
right,
able to take that further.
Right, and so often,
good idea.
If you don't have that emotional spark, then you can't really get past that. So are you saying it's 2 o'clock?
It's 2 o'clock.
Aww.
We've exceeded our time limit. I know. I did want to say one other thing about this. We're going to finish this up next week because the next section I really, really want to talk about how the play looks different in these kids with sensory processing disorder, since we didn't get to talk about that today.
We could probably do a week or a month of that.
So we'll plan on that next week.
Okay.
And hopefully we can have Carry on. But I do want to do a little programming note. Next week our show is not going to be on Friday at 1 o'clock. We're going to have to do that late in the afternoon on Thursday. So most of our listeners, I think, actually don't listen live. I think they listen after, you know, either from the website or iTunes or somewhere. So that's not going to be a big deal for them, but for our listeners who listen to us live on Friday, we're not going to be on. We're going to be on late for the next 2 Thursdays in a row, since I'm going to be out of town next week and you're going to be out of town the week after that. So that's just a little programming note.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for a great show, Kate.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later.
Bye.